jailed Palestinian man unable to move or talk after nearly 170 days of hunger strike. According to his lawyer, he is not giving up until Israel ends his open-ended detention. 9 European countries expressed concern about Israel's raids and offices of Palestinian NGOs in the occupied West Bank. They called Tel Aviv's allegations against the organizations unsubstantiated. Also, Russia's president warns Ukraine's systematic shelling of the Russian-controlled Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant can lead to a large-scale nuclear disaster. Thank you for joining us. Our top story this hour, the lawyer of a Palestinian hunger striker says he is set to continue refusing food until Israel cancels his open-ended detention. According to the lawyer, Khalil Awavdi's health has deteriorated to the point that he cannot move or talk. An Israeli court has rejected Awavdi's appeal for release. The father of four has been refusing food for nearly 170 days to protest his indefinite imprisonment without charge or trial. That's under a policy Israel calls administrative detention. Several other Palestinian prisoners face the same plight and have gone on hunger strikes in acts of protest. The regime is holding around 670 Palestinians in administrative detention. More reactions coming after the Israeli military raided offices of several Palestinian NGOs in the occupied West Bank. 9 European countries, including France and Germany, have thrown their weight behind the Palestinian organizations.
We are deeply concerned by the raids which took place in the morning of 18th of August as part of a worrying reduction of space for civil society in the occupied Palestinian territory. These actions are not acceptable. We stand firm with NGOs to uphold the right to freedom of expression and association in the occupied Palestinian territory.
The European countries also called Israel's allegations against the NGOs unsubstantiated. Earlier, the Palestinian Foreign Ministry said Israeli forces looted documents and seized equipment before closing the NGOs' offices. The ministry warned that civil society and human rights groups remain the prime target of the regime because they document its crimes against Palestinians. The ministry called on the international community to provide urgent protection for the groups targeted on Thursday.
The Israeli military shut down 7 Palestinian non-governmental civil society and human rights organizations in the occupied West Bank. Early on Thursday, the Israeli military raided occupied Ramallah and broke into the offices of the organizations. The offices were ransacked and their equipment confiscated. Doors were welded shut with an Israeli military order posted on them declaring the organizations unlawful. The groups have decried the move as politically motivated and baseless.
They are targeting by the seven organizations. They are targeting the civil society sector in Palestine and the human rights sector in general. So the message was, any organization talked about expose the Israeli policy, talked about the Israeli crimes will be targeted and will be silent. Again, the message also for the international organizations and of course also for the EU states, those who are rejected the Israeli allegation against the organizations. This is a message that Israel is above the law.
Israel has outlawed 6 of these NGOs, which were labeled as terrorist organizations in October 2021, and accused them of funneling donor aid to militants and had ties to the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, a Palestinian left-wing movement. The organizations that have been outlawed by Israel are Ad-Damir and Al-Haq, which document human rights violations, and the Union of Palestinian Women's Committees, Bissan Center for Research, DCI, Defense for Children International Palestine, as well as the Union of Agricultural Work Committees. The 7th organization was the Union of Health Work Committees.
We will continue our work. Work in this field, it's not a job. It's not a job. The Israelis continue their atrocities, their oppression against us, against the rest of the civil society organizations here. But this will not stop us, and this will not push us back, and we will not give up, and we will continue. We know that we pay price, maybe personal price, maybe different kind of a price, but we are ready to defend, to fight for the principles that we do believe.
The United Nations Human Rights Office has meanwhile expressed alarm at Israel's arbitrary closure of organizations and called on Israel to immediately reverse these decisions, reiterating the High Commissioner's call to revoke the designations of the organizations as terrorist and unlawful.
The Israeli regime has added to its illegal practices which aim to silence the Palestinian people. Today, not only does it continue to suppress Palestinian people, the regime also quells these organizations and human rights advocates. Mona Kandil, Occupy Ramallah.
Turkey's main opposition party, CHP, has criticized what it calls the government's double standards in dealing with the Palestinian cause. The criticism allows or follows Ankara's decision to normalize ties with Israel. Roshan Saglam has more from Istanbul.
Turkish main opposition party CHP has criticized the government for, quote, its double standards in regards with the Palestinian cause. The reaction was made after Turkey announced that it will appoint an ambassador to Israel, 4 years after Ankara cut its ties with the regime over the killing of 60 Palestinians by Israeli forces during a protest on the Gaza border. Deputy chairman of CHP parliamentary bloc Engin Özkoç said, it seems the AKP has not heard about Israel's latest aggression in Gaza, adding the government has forgotten its promises to Palestinians.
Erdogan used to describe Israel as a child killer and a terrorist regime. Since the Marmara incident in 2010, Erdogan set conditions for normalizing relations with Israel. Those conditions weren't met, but what has changed now? Israel's killing of Palestinian children continues and has not stopped. A week ago, Palestinian children were killed in Gaza by Israel. Hasn't AKP heard about Israel's killing of children in Gaza in the latest Israeli attack? And now, they are rushing to normalize relations with Israel? They deal with the file in two different ways, and they have forgotten their promises to the Palestinians and our people as well.
Turkish Foreign Minister Mevlüt Çavuşoğlu said, Turkey is not giving up on the Palestinian cause. However, it is important for their messages to be conveyed directly through the ambassadors. For the past few months, Turkey and Israel have been trying to normalize ties. Back in March, they announced a new era in their relations after the Israeli president paid a visit to Ankara and met Erdogan. Turkish people have always criticized the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian land. They have repeatedly taken to the streets to protest against the Israeli aggression in the Gaza Strip. While anti-Israeli sentiment runs high in Turkey, analysts say Ankara's whole foreign policy is changing, with this normalization being part of a new political strategy taken by the Erdogan administration. Roshan Saglam, Istanbul.
The commander of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps says Israel failed to achieve its goal of dividing Palestinians during its recent aggression against the Gaza Strip. In an interview, Major General Hossein Salami said Israel sought to split Palestinian groups by singling out the Islamic Jihad as its target. But he said other Palestinian groups provided spiritual support and were ready to enter the fray as the Islamic Jihad fought the regime. Salami noted that Israel couldn't even continue the battle against one resistance movement. The regime launched airstrikes on Gaza earlier this month, killing 49 Palestinians, including 16 children. The Islamic Jihad responded with a barrage of rockets targeting Israeli cities. An Egyptian-mediated truce brought the conflict to an end after 3 days. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman says the U.S. is a world leader in meddling, staging coups, and military attacks against sovereign nations and governments. In a tweet, Nasser Kanani says, the 1953 U.S.-led coup in Iran is an example of this dark U.S. history. Friday marks the anniversary of the putsch, which saw the overthrow of the democratically elected government of Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh. Kanani says the U.S. has for decades been following an erroneous and failed policy towards Iran and violating the legitimate rights of the Iranian nation. He wondered if the U.S. is now ready to change track and rectify this approach.
On our August 19, 1953, the U.S. with the help of Britain staged a coup against the democratically elected government of then-Iranian Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh. They did so as Mossadegh sought to limit the control of Britain's Anglo-Iranian oil company, the AIOC, over Iranian petroleum reserves. Mossadegh had introduced a bill to nationalize Iran's oil industry. It was passed by the Iranian parliament on March 20, 1951. Mossadegh's decision was also backed by religious figures led by prominent cleric Ayatollah Abul Qasem Kashani. As a result of the efforts, Britain's four-decade rule over Iran's oil industry came to an end. The AIOC had enjoyed monopolistic control over the nation's oil industry and used to pay only a small share of the revenues to the Iranian government. In retaliation to Mossadegh's move, Britain and the United States imposed sanctions against Iran's oil industry. They also staged their coup to topple Mossadegh and replaced him with a Western-backed monarch, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi. After several decades, the U.S. admitted its role in the coup. That was confirmed in documents the CIA published in 2013. According to those documents, the CIA begins drafting a plan to bring to power through covert action a government in Iran that would be preferred by the United States. May 13. The CIA and British intelligence officers meet in Nicosia, Cyprus, to draft plans for the coup. The CIA's Tehran station is also granted approval to launch a great propaganda campaign to discredit Mossadegh's government. British Prime Minister Winston Churchill gives final approval to the operational plan for the coup. U.S. President Dwight Eisenhower gives the same approval, too. Mossadegh, suspecting the British and American governments were plotting against him, holds a referendum calling for the Iranian parliament to be dissolved. Mohammad Reza Shah signs a royal decree dismissing Mossadegh. Word of the Shah's support for the coup spreads quickly across Iran. The coup begins, but falters and then fails because Mossadegh received advance warning of the plans. The Shah flees to Iraqi capital Baghdad. Several Tehran newspapers publish Mohammad Reza Shah's decree. Thugs and ruffians paid to demonstrate take to the streets, and another coup begins. General Fazlullah Zahiri comes out of hiding to lead the movement. By the end of the day, Iran falls into Zahiri's hands, and members of the Mossadegh government either go to hiding or are imprisoned. The U.S. benefited from ousting Mossadegh and usurped a significant share of Iran's oil wealth following the notorious coup. The Shah's pro-Western dictatorship continued for 27 years. It ended with a 1979 Islamic revolution that paved the way for today's Iran.
The Russian president has accused Kiev of systematic shelling of Europe's largest nuclear power plant in southern Ukraine. Vladimir Putin raised the alarm about the repercussions of attacks on the site. Putin was speaking in a phone call with his French counterpart Emmanuel Macron. He said the shelling of the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant has created danger of a large-scale catastrophe that could lead to radiation contamination of vast territories. The two leaders called for independent inspections at the site. Moscow and Kiev have accused each other of planning provocations at the plant. Russia captured Zaporizhia in March. The facility, however, is run by Ukrainian technicians. Mali has accused France of violating its airspace in addition to providing weapons to terrorists and armed groups, this with the aim of destabilizing Mali. Why would France want to do that? Mali, however, is very serious about its accusations, requesting a special session at the UN Security Council to prevent France from continuing its destabilizing actions.
Tensions are once again heating up between France and its former colony, Mali. The African nation has accused the European country of violating its territorial integrity and arming terrorists. Malian Foreign Ministry has written a letter to the head of the United Nations Security Council urging the body to punish France over its interventionist policies in Mali. We have several pieces of evidence that these flagrant violations of Malian airspace were used by France to collect intelligence for terrorist groups operating in the Sahel and to drop arms and ammunition to them. Mali has called on the UN Security Council to ensure that France, quote, immediately ceases its acts of aggression. Mali has cited an attack on Tessit camp as evidence of the meddling of France in the African nation.
As to what gains France will have from arming the terrorist groups and operating across Mali, in northern Mali specifically, I think the French are very angry because they have been kicked out of Mali by the Malian authorities, and they are about to finish their evacuation, military bases evacuation from the country, if they have not finished already.
Mali says after the attack, which claimed the lives of 42 soldiers, quote, clandestine and uncoordinated overflight operations were conducted. Mali also says it reserves the right to use self-defense in the face of measures that undermine the stability of the African nation. France has, however, rejected the allegation, saying it's actually fighting the terrorists.
Essentially, the problem here is the French want to cling to the West African country in Mali and across the region, the Sahel region, for as long as possible. This is their traditional sphere of influence, and they would prefer to stay there.
Well, that's your world news for now. Stay tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Concrete efforts and not cosmetic measures are required to end the plight of the Rohingya Muslims, says Kayhan International staff writer in an article published under the heading Onus on UN to End Plight of Rohingya Refugees. Stay tuned for more. Concrete efforts and not cosmetic measures are required to end the plight of the Rohingya Muslims, whether they're refugees who have sought temporary asylum abroad, such as the million-odd languishing in camps in Bangladesh, or those still living in their once-flourishing homeland under persecution, torture, and periodic bouts of genocide. The United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, who toured refugee camps in Bangladesh recently and met groups of Rohingyas, should realize the gravity of the situation of these displaced people, deprived of normal life, including education for children. It is rather a belated visit to the Rohingya refugee camps by Michelle Bachelet, a former Chilean president who has been UN High Commissioner for Human Rights since 2018. Nevertheless, it is a welcome visit in view of the bright record of Ms. Bachelet, both during her 2 4-year terms as president of Chile that saw promotion of literacy amongst hundreds of thousands of poor families through distribution of free briefcases, including books, including encyclopedias, dictionaries, poetry works and books, and her castigation of Saudi Arabia for its war crimes in Yemen, as well as her criticism of the Zionist regime for the recent killing of journalist Shirin Abu Akleh. She had said, chronically high levels of killings and injuries of Palestinians, including children by Israeli forces in the occupied Palestinian territory, have continued. These documented words of the UN High Commissioner of Human Rights are indeed soothing for the Rohingya refugees who have not seen anything of note done by the world body or the so-called advocates of democracy. Bachelet, during her four-day visit, has met Bangladesh Foreign, Home, Law and Education Ministers and also Shamsuddouza, the host country's Deputy Refugee Relief and Repatriation Commissioner, as well as human rights activists and NGOs who briefed her about the situation in Bangladesh. While appreciating Bangladesh's humanitarian gesture towards the Rohingyas, Bachelet, a physician by profession and a committed socialist, underscored the need for the education of refugees through the learning centers in the camps, as well as proper sanitary measures. This is indeed a positive development for Rohingya refugees who are in sore need of education for children and young adults, in addition to adequate health and hygienic amenities. If Bachelet, who has met with Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina before wrapping up her visit, could implement education and health programs for the refugees in coordination with the government of Bangladesh, she would have done a great job. It is the duty of the UN to highlight the atrocities of the Myanmar regime while taking concrete steps to repatriate the Rohingyas to their homeland with guarantee that their birthright will never again be violated. Hopefully, Bachelet will succeed in view of her record as president of Chile in opening in Santiago the Museum of Memory and Human Rights, documenting the horrors of General Augusto Pinochet's 16.5-year U.S.-backed dictatorship and her making the Chilean Army Chief General Juan Emilio Chere to sign the Never Again Declaration in 2003 that the military will never subvert democracy in Chile.
Food for thought. Hello, dear friends, and here is some food for thought from the immortal martyr of Karbala, Imam Hussein, peace be upon him. The real stingy person is the one who refrains from greeting. Thank you.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
This is A to Z, an introduction into Husseini lifestyle. Today's lesson, Imam al-Husseini's firmness on the path of truth. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Welcome everyone. You're listening to A to Z program from the IRB English Radio. I'm your host, Hussein Hinzano. And in today's lesson, we're talking about the firmness on the path of truth that Al-Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam took during his time, during his period of leadership. Steadfastness on the path of truth was one of the most prominent qualities of the father of the martyrs, Imam Hussein alayhi salam, because for the establishment of truth and for the destruction of the facts of falsehood and centers of oppression, Imam Hussein exhibited an unequaled perseverance. He was so persevering. The Holy Imam had in his view truth with all its vastness and meanings, and he set out for the field of contest so that truth may be established in all Islamic lands and the people may be released from atrocities meted out to them by tyrannical rulers of the time and dispel forces. So Imam Hussein was so firm at the time that he had besieged him. He had besieged him and events that had subjected people to deep pits of ignorance where they were thrashing their limbs for survival. Imam alayhi salam saw that the community was sinking in falsehood and deviations, and people were not having any values in their life. Therefore, he proceeded towards the field of confrontation so that he may sacrifice everything for the sake of hoisting the flag of truth. The Imam alayhi salam has mentioned this same illuminated aim in his address to his companions. This was the type of firmness Al-Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam used to have during the time of his rulership, during the time of his leadership.
Why is my heart set on fire when I hear your name?
As-salamu alayk, ya Aba Abdullah.
Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z program from the IRB English Radio. I'm your host, Hussein Hinzano, and we are talking in this very particular moment about the firmness on the path of the truth. The firmness that Al-Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam had on the path of truth. He stood with truth whenever it came, like his father did, like his grandfather, Prophet Muhammad, did. He said every time he felt that this is the path of truth, he went through the same path, and he never chose any other path other than that. Imam Hussein is reported to be having this particular firmness on the path of truth, that he is reported to be saying, or he once said to his companions, "Oh my companions, do you not see that truth is not being practiced and falsehood is not being avoided so that a believer may be eager to meet the Lord?" Truth was one of the most prominent qualities of the personality of the father of martyrs, Al-Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. It was one of his main prominent qualities that he had inherited them. He had inherited those qualities from his grandfather. And that is the reason why he used to, you know, time and again kiss that same face and the same mouth that spoke up the words of Allah and issued the springs of justice and truth on the earth. This is a quality that Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam can be easily say that he inherited it from his grandfather, the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, and from his father, al-Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam. It's a trait that every leader in our time should try and portray, should try and have, to be firm on the path of truth. It's the path that whenever any leader follows it, definitely he's going to be a successful leader, and the people under him are going to gain a lot and to live a life that is supposed to be lived according to the teachings of the Prophet and the teachings of the Book of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Thank you so much for listening to this episode. Inshallah, until next episode, I will meet you inshallah. I've been your host, Hussein Hinzano. Until next time, fi amanillah. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of A to Z. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com/en-islam-page, where you can find all our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode and another lesson, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Better friends than you, but anyone stay here won't be alive tomorrow. You can save yourself tonight and go. A deep silence, feel the air.
Cultural news, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With delight.
England's Paradise Wildlife Park welcomes its new guest, an endangered red panda cub. The mother, Tilly, gave birth to the cub just 1 month after she lost her breeding partner, Nampang. Experts say Tilly had been under a breeding project for 4 years. The cub has been named Little Red, and his birth is being celebrated as a, quote, symbol of hope. Red pandas are classed as an endangered species and are on the red list of the International Union for Conservation of Nature. The bushy-tailed bamboo munchers dwell in high-altitude Asian forests, and their population is now fewer than 2,500. Lightning strikes are a very powerful and misunderstood force of nature that we all often see being used in films. A spectacular lightning strike has illuminated the sky over the Scottish town of Dundee. A video from an eyewitness that captured the hypnotic scene has been shared on several social media platforms. The lightning in the clip can be seen sending several bolts in opposite directions. Below, a church spire is silhouetted against the lightning flashes. But lightning is not always spectacular, as sometimes it causes fire to tower and high rises. Last month, a wind turbine caught fire after being struck by a lightning bolt in North Texas, United States. Forestry authorities in southwestern China have opened a new canteen for wild Asian elephants in a bid to stop them wandering into villages. The canteen in Yunnan province provides the animals with attractive and nutritious meals while exploring man-animal harmonious coexistence. During these years, the province has explored multiple ways to reduce the encounters between humans and elephants and try to keep the animals away from farmers' crops. There are now approximately 1,400 hectares of dining halls for elephants, with many expanding from 100 to 240, such as corn, rice and sugarcane. They are planted on a large scale and within easy reach of the elephants. The location of such canteens is extremely selective, usually away from villages and major roads, and the chefs are locals.
Stunning scenes in Spain as the last supermoon of the year illuminates the night sky amid fireworks and fairs marking the start of festivities for a public holiday. In Malaga, fireworks left the sky a mix of colours against the bright moon. There was also a spectacle of drones that lightened the sturgeon moon. Locals in the Canary Islands also celebrated the three-day holiday by lighting up a Ferris wheel as the full moon beamed beautifully in the sky. If the moon is within 10% of its closest distance to Earth at the moment of full moon, it is called a supermoon. The supermoon has various hues and appears bigger and brighter than when the moon is at its farthest point from Earth. Have you ever heard of fighting nature with nature? Well, that's what the San Francisco metro system in the U.S. did to stop pigeons from overrunning the place. The station has hired a hawk as the new guard to patrol the area. Pac-Man is a 5-year-old Harris's hawk who has taken up the perch at the station. In terms of experience, he is pretty new, as he finished training only 9 months ago. The station recently renovated its building, installing netting and spikes to prevent pigeons from nesting. But these birds still seem to find their way to hang around. So with the Falconer Force, Ricky Ortiz and his hawk were hired this summer to keep the pigeons at bay.
So a typical day is we get here, we make our round, we start off down in the bottom inside the facility, making sure there's no pigeons hanging out in there. And then we work our way up here to the platforms and just check the ledges and the roof and make sure that they're not trying to sneak in on us and keep them out. And he does a pretty good job of that.
The team patrols 3 days a week and Pac-Man is allowed to swoop in and scare any pigeons sitting around. The Falconer says less than half of the pigeons left after the first week of Pac-Man flying and establishing the territory. Commuters and station managers say they also noticed the difference. The Falconer says he usually keeps his feathery friend happy on the job by giving him snacks throughout the day. This also encourages the hawk not to feast on the pigeons and local rodents.
Technology helps transform the global food production system and mitigates its impact on the environment. China's autonomous region of Tibet is turning barren land into fertile one using greenhouse technology. Once removed, Beinan County is now the largest off-season vegetable supplier in Tibet. The region has taken advantage of its highland conditions to develop a state-of-the-art agricultural structure. Beinong has now more than 2,200 modern vegetable greenhouses and nearly 12,000 hectares of planting area, some built at unimaginable altitude. But one cannot deny the role of railways and highway transport for making this county a hub for organic vegetables. The income of locals has also been significantly improved, and they are now living a happy and prosperous life.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
If you're a private collector of wild animals, there is good news for you. A Pakistani zoo is auctioning off a dozen lions due to a lack of money to feed them and a space to house them. Lahore Safari Zoo currently has so many big cats that they have to take turns accessing paddocks. Officials say auctioning them will free up space and also reduce expenses. Zoo is currently housing 29 lions. The lions auctioned this week will be between 2 to 5 years of age. Each big cat is estimated to fetch around 150,000 Pakistan rupees. That's not too much, as some zookeepers claim. Even conservationists have expressed anger over auctioning lions to private collectors instead of transferring them to other zoos. Happy news for zoo goers in Nicaragua. Two adorable baby tapirs are born at a country's national zoo south of Managua, adding attractions to the visitors. Two endangered tapirs, a male and a female, were born hours apart at the weekend. In a video shared by the zoo, one of the newborns is seen suckling and walking near her mother. The director of the zoo says the babies are yet to be named but are in perfect health. Tapirs inhabit jungle and forest regions of South and Central America, with one species inhabiting Southeast Asia. They look something like pigs with trunks, but they are actually related to horses and rhinos. Nicaragua launched a project that seeks to conserve this animal in danger of extinction due to hunting and the destruction of natural habitat. Now we'll take you to mine-riddled French island, Chazoms, which is emerging from the ruins and gradually turning into workers' paradise. Chazoms, close to the port city of Saint-Malo, has an amazing landscape but remains uninhabited as it saw a devastating bombardment by the Allies during the World War II. The Nazi-occupied island was victim of the most bombings per square meter. Known as Martyred and Forbidden Island, it was opened only in 2018 after extensive demining efforts allowed the opening of a marked path. Now, every year, thousands of day trippers make the short boat journey, marveling at the spectacular maritime views and flourishing wildlife there. The safe area still makes up just 3% of the island, but it lets visitors wander between rusty cannons and bunkers. Some workers say they hope the trail will be lengthened to allow a complete tour of the island.
Africa is taking back some of its greatest treasures stolen by the British back in the 19th century. The Horniman Museum in London has agreed to return the artifacts to Nigeria. These are 72 relics, which include 12 highly treasured brass plaques known as the Benin Bronzes. The bronzes are a group of several thousand metal plaques and sculptures that decorated the royal palace of the once mighty kingdom of Benin since the 16th century. These artifacts were looted from a region in modern-day Nigeria in a British military incursion. They later ended up in museums in Europe and the U.S. African countries have been fighting to recover works pillaged by explorers and colonizers as Western institutions grapple with the cultural legacy of colonialism. The Jamtal Glacier in Austria has been losing around 1 meter of its surface annually. Scientists say the ice is a precious archive that is simply melting away and are surveying the area. Austrian mountain researchers say the glaciers contain an invaluable trove of ancient frozen leaves and twigs and other scientific treasures that can be lost forever. They say the time capsules, including the remote Jamtal Valley, are falling victim to climate change. In the 1990s, tourists found that 5,300-year-old mummy of Iceman near the same area. According to the international data, global warming has raised temperatures in Europe's highest mountains by nearly 2 degrees Celsius in the past 120 years. French rescuers are racing against time to save a beluga whale stranded in Seine River near Paris. The beluga was first spotted stuck between two locks in the river from Paris to the English Channel on Tuesday. Specialists say the animal is undernourished and is refusing food. Warm water is also worsening the health of this creature, which is normally seen near Norway, some 3,000 kilometers to the north. Rescuers say they have only up to 48 hours to save the whale. They are now looking at the possibility of taking the beluga out of the water, treating it, and eventually transferring it out to the sea.
There are many big restaurants with Michelin stars awarded based on their quality. But you will be amazed to know that an eatery located in a tiny village in Greenland also has this badge of honor, making it the world's most remote Michelin-starred restaurant. This eatery in the village, which is home to only 53 people, serves you what it gets from its immediate surroundings. Looking out over the chilly North Atlantic, customers taste a variety of local products, ranging from whale skin to an Arctic bird whose entire wing, including feathers, is on the plate. The restaurant is so remote that you can only reach there by boat through floating icebergs. The head chef says he forages for wild berries, flowers, and herbs every day, since the menu largely includes local flavors.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Nearly every political figure in Washington invariably agrees on endlessly adding to the Pentagon's already staggering budget, says Andrea Mazzarino Ryder in an article published under the heading, "The U.S. Costs of Investing in War and Not Human Livelihood." Stay tuned for the details, please. The American military is now having trouble recruiting enough soldiers. According to the New York Times, its ranks are short thousands of entry-level troops and is on track to face the worst recruitment crisis since the Vietnam War ended, not long after the draft was eliminated. Mind you, it's not that military doesn't have the resources for recruitment drives. Nearly every political figure in Washington, including House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, invariably agrees on endlessly adding to the Pentagon's already staggering budget. In fact, it's nearly the only thing they seem capable of agreeing on. After all, Congress has already taken nearly a year to pass a social spending package roughly half the size of this year's defense budget, even though that bill would mitigate the cost of healthcare for so many Americans and invest in clean energy for years to come. Forget about more money for early childhood education. Nor is the Pentagon shy about spending from its bloated wallet to woo new recruits. It's even
cold calling possible candidates and offering enlistment bonuses of up to $50,000. As it happens, though, its recruiters keep running into some common problems that either prevent young people from enlisting or from even wanting to do so, including the poor physical or mental health of all too many of them, their mistrust of the government and its wars, and the recent pandemic-related school closures that made it so much harder for recruiters to build relationships with high school kids. Many of these recruitment issues are also all-American ones related to the deteriorating quality of life in the U.S. Thanks in part to growing wealth inequalities in the U.S. and what often seems to be a perpetual stalemate in Congress regarding social spending, the next generation of would-be fighters turn out to be in surprisingly rough shape. It's no secret that the U.S. military targets low-income communities in its recruitment drives. It has a long record, for instance, of focusing on high schools that have higher proportions of poor students. Recruiters are also reportedly showing up at strip malls, fast food joints, and even big box stores, the places that is where many poor and working class Americans labor, eat, or shop. So, too, has the military and the rest of the national security state piggybacked on an American love of screens. The alliance between Hollywood and military recruiters goes all the way back to the First World War. After the attacks of September 11, 2001, however, the government stepped up its efforts to sell the country's latest wars to the public, presenting them as a ticket to greater opportunities for those who enlisted and, of course, a patriotic fight against terrorism. The smoke had barely cleared from the site of the Twin Towers when Pentagon officials began meeting with Hollywood directors to imagine future war scenarios in which the U.S. might be involved. Present at those meetings were the directors of movies like Delta Force One, Missing in Action, and Fight Club. As a result, in a country where basic services like school and healthcare have been harder to access due to COVID-19, the few spaces for social interaction available to many vulnerable Americans have remained saturated with violence. The casualties of not caring for own in this way are high. According to the National Institutes of Health, an estimated 300,000 deaths each year are due to the U.S. obesity epidemic. Unfortunately, deadly as such, a phenomenon might prove to be. It doesn't make for the sort of gripping plots that popular movies need. Similarly, the military's recruitment efforts suffer because of poor mental health levels among young people. One in five young women and one in 10 young men experience an episode of major depression before turning 25. Meanwhile, the suicide rate in the U.S. is the highest among wealthy nations, and now, thanks in part to all the weapons flooding this society, is also the second leading cause of death among 10 to 24-year-olds. Worse yet, poor kids are significantly more likely to die by suicide. Globally, wealth and race-based inequalities are key detriments of mental health, in part because people who sense that the world they live in is deeply unfair are more likely to develop clinical mental health disorders. A 2019 United Nations report suggested that in order to improve mental health, governments ought to focus on investing in social programs to support people who have experienced trauma, abuse, and neglect at home or in their neighborhoods. It seems unlikely, though, that U.S. elected representatives are ready for such things. The human frailties that hinder enlistments are symptoms of something more sinister than a military lacking bodies.
The threat that is guaranteed to further undermine any American readiness to face life as it should be faced in this discordant 21st century with its ever more feverish summers is the dismantling of U.S. democratic system. A recent survey ranked the U.S. only 26th globally when it comes to the quality of its democracy. And that's sad because functional democratic systems are better at creating conditions in which people can help each other and be involved in public service of all sorts, yes, including in the military. Democracies are also better at educating people and generally have more efficient healthcare systems, in part due to the lesser likelihood of corruption. Democracies have less criminal violence and less likelihood of civil war. In a true democracy, where the peaceful transition of power is a given, the kinds of emergencies that necessitate a strong military and law enforcement response are much less likely. Which is why the January 6th insurrection at the Capitol was so ominous. Worse yet, investing in weapons rather than human livelihood is guaranteed to have costs that are not only far-reaching but hard to predict. One thing is certain, though. War and ever greater preparations for more of it do not lay the groundwork for a good democracy.
Midstream.
In the battle for the unity of battlefields, Al-Quds brigades mainly demonstrated its ability to confront the Israeli scheme and thwart the project of dismantling and separating the resistance arenas from one another or singling out one specific arena, the Islamic Jihad. Yet, shall we call it the three-day battle, or the battle to establish new rules of engagement made by the past 7 months of 2022? Or say the after sword of Al-Quds war? Or do we call it the victory of the resistance with hellfire on the army and government of the Zionist entity? Perhaps all of these titles are identical to the results of the recent confrontation waged by the Islamic Jihad resistance movement and its military arm, the Al-Quds Brigades, embraced and supported by the mighty resistance base in the Gaza Strip, which is led by the Izzeddin Al-Qassam Brigades. In his press conference, Ziad al-Nakhali, Secretary General of the Islamic Jihad, stressed that the result of this battle, as well as its main goal, was to unify the battlefields as established by the sword of Al-Quds war, as well as to confirm that the resistance was and still is united, despite the diversity of positions within it that pour all in one direction, the war of liberation against the Zionist enemy. The latest Israeli war on the Gaza Strip kicked off after Israel assassinated prominent leaders of Al-Quds brigades in a round of confrontation that lasted for more than 50 continuous hours. The Islamic Jihad responded by striking the occupied Palestinian territories, starting from the settlements of the Gaza envelope to the Israeli depth in Tel Aviv, with more than 1,000 missiles and shells. Al-Quds brigades fought back to express the unity of Palestine's land with one aim, thwarting Israel's project aimed at invading one resistance battlefield while excluding others. Israel's central goal lies in getting rid of the effect of the Battle of Saif al-Quds, the Sword of al-Quds, and its consequences. However, the end result was that Al-Quds brigades proved its ability to confront the Israeli schemes, crimes, and incursions on the one hand, and fixating the equation of the Battle of the Sword of Al-Quds on the other, all the while emphasizing the results of the battle of the unity and interconnection of all the resistance arenas inside Palestine. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. Israeli aggression on the Gaza Strip started after Israel assassinated prominent leaders of the